Chapter 6, Burning the HIV Heretics. "Why they did it," he says, "I cannot figure out. Nobody in their right mind would jump into this thing like they did. The Secretary of Health just announcing to the world like that that this man Robert Gallo, wearing those dark sunglasses, had found the cause of AIDS. It had nothing to do with any well-considered science. There were some people who had AIDS, and some of them had HIV, not even all of them. So they had a correlation. So what?" Kerry Mullis, PhD, Nobel laureate, PCR inventor. In 1991, 7 years after Robert Gallo's May 1984 article in Science, Harvard microbiologist Dr. Charles Thomas organized the Eminence Greases of Virology and Immunology to formally register their objections to Gallo's HIV hypothesis in an historical letter to Nature. The group was a who's who of international scientific doyens and Nobel laureates, among them Dr. Walter Gilbert of Harvard, PCR inventor Kerry Mullis, Yale mathematician Serge Lange, a member and watchdog of the National Academy of Sciences, Dr. Harry Rubin, professor of cell biology at UC Berkeley, Dr. Harvey Bialy, co-founder of Nature Biotechnology, Bernard Forsher, PhD, retired editor of Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and many others. The letter was only 4 sentences long. "It is widely believed by the general public that a retrovirus called HIV causes a group of diseases called AIDS. Many biomedical scientists now question this hypothesis. We propose a thorough reappraisal of the existing evidence for and against this hypothesis to be conducted by a suitable independent group. We further propose that the critical epidemiological studies be devised and undertaken." It seemed like a reasonable request. These esteemed researchers were only asking for the open debate and investigation about an extremely consequential scientific assertion that had somehow never occurred. But in an early display of Dr. Fauci's and Big Pharma's combined power to control the medical journals, Nature declined to publish the letter, nor would New England Journal of Medicine, JAMA, or The Lancet. These journals rely on the pharmaceutical industry for upward of 90% of their revenues and seldom publish studies that threaten the pharma paradigm. As Lancet editor Richard Horton has observed, the journals have devolved into information laundering operations for the pharmaceutical industry. Dr. Fauci exercises direct influence on the content that appears in their journals. Control of peer-reviewed publishing is a vital ingredient for constructing orthodoxies. When Nature rejected the letter, Thomas and Bialy subsequently organized a consortium, the Group for Scientific Reappraisal of HIV-AIDS Hypothesis, and in 1992 Thomas called it tantamount to criminal negligence for scientists to remain silent. Of the 53 who had signed by June 1992, 12 had MDs and 25 had PhDs. 20 of the 53 gave academic affiliations with departments like physiology, biochemistry, medicine, pharmacology, toxicology, and physics. Over 2,600 people, including 3 Nobel laureates, Walter Gilbert, Kerry Mullis, and 2-time winner Linus Pauling, and 188 reputable PhDs, added their signatures. Rethinking AIDS website lists more than 2,000 distinguished members at www.rethinkingaids.com. But the steady flow of money from NIAID was already annealing Gallo's viral hypothesis into iron-bound orthodoxy, and those dissenting voices met the hardened steel of fortified institutional resistance. Tony Fauci's loosened purse strings had launched the HIV gold rush, and the government virologists and pharmaceutical PIs had circled their stagecoaches around Gallo's sketchy hypothesis and were lined up for handouts at the NIAID chuckwagon. "They've got to hold on to HIV. Why?" observed Dr. Charles Thomas dolefully. "To hold on to their funding." Scratching his head, Kerry Mullis commented, "There's something wrong here. It's got to be financial." He explained, "The mystery of that damn virus," he says, "has been generated by the $2 billion a year they spend on it. You take any other virus and spend $2 billion, and you can make up some great mysteries about it, too." Peter Duisberg. Among the scientists who added their name to the later version of the letter was an iconoclastic German-born prodigy with twinkling eyes, a biting wit, a boyish face, and a ready smile. In the 1970s and 1980s, molecular biologist Professor Peter Duisberg, born December 2, 1936, was a demigod of molecular biology and among the world's best known and highly respected scientists. The National Institutes of Health, NIH, generously supported his virology and cancer research. In 1986, NIH awarded Duisberg its Special Cancer Fellowship, as well as the highly coveted Outstanding Investigator Grant, which the agency reserves for the top scientists in the country. NIH designed the 7-year grant to allow gifted scientists to push the boundaries of their specialties by removing the pressures of grant writing. The elite National Academy of Sciences inducted Duisberg into its Scientist Hall of Fame at the age of 50, making him one of its youngest members ever. At the University of California, Berkeley, Duisberg became the first to map the genetic structure of retroviruses like HIV, making him among the world's most renowned retrovirologists. A retrovirus is a primitive life form that has no capacity to replicate on its own, as is true of all viruses. The retrovirus injects its RNA into an existing cell, where an enzyme called reverse transcriptase converts viral RNA into DNA, which is then inserted or spliced into the host cell's DNA. Virologists generally believe that retroviruses are harmless, even beneficial, in a symbiotic relationship with humans during 3 billion years of evolution, providing mobile DNA blocks in the human genome. In fact, many of our genes first entered our genome as retroviruses. Some 8 to 10% of human DNA is retroviral, says Dr. David Rasnick. That's a hell of a lot. By 1970, at 33, Duisberg won acclaim for having discovered the first cancer-causing gene. Duisberg and his fellow virologist Peter Vogt discovered the so-called oncogene inside a retrovirus that appeared to cause cancer. Duisberg's discovery gave rise to the mutant gene theory and unleashed a boom in a new discipline of cancer research. Colleagues expected Duisberg to win the Nobel Prize. But Duisberg was the consummate scientist, believing researchers ought to experiment and reason from what they observe and ruthlessly question every orthodoxy, including their own. Duisberg therefore subjected his oncogene theory to more rigorous tests than had any of its critics. Before he got the magical call from Stockholm, Duisberg became convinced that his own momentous discovery had been a clinically irrelevant lab fluke. Publicly shrugging off his hypothesis, which had already electrified a new field, Duisberg himself debunked the theory, incinerating his Nobel prospects and his friendship with Peter Vogt. Harvey Bialy, Duisberg's biographer, reports Duisberg saying, "I would prefer to be honest even against my own interests." Duisberg was uncompromisingly committed to clean functional proof at a time when electron microscopy and other technologies for detecting new viruses were making biology, particularly the study of viruses, increasingly murky. fame and finance were driving the frenzy in viral research. With official and commercial encouragement, researchers were blaming newly discovered viruses as the culprits in an assortment of ancient diseases. NIAID and pharmaceutical companies readily funded this research, which often opened a straight path to patentable antivirals. A virologist who convincingly linked a new virus to an existing cancer or disease could enjoy relevance, rich financial remuneration, and professional glory. Pharmaceutical companies were minting profits from a pharmacopoeia of patented antivirals devised by isolating these viruses and identifying compounds that could kill them. Every research scientist was aware of the Nobel Committee's bias toward breakthroughs that boosted pharma's profit potentials. From the outset, Duisberg had nagging doubts about Robert Gallo's findings. From an evolutionary standpoint, it didn't make sense that an ancient retrovirus would attack its human host. Retroviruses in the form of incomplete strands of DNA inserted into human DNA have no metabolism and no proven capacity to digest, reproduce, or evolve. They are not, by accepted definition, a life form. It would be a surprise if evolution had, through some unknown mechanism, transformed any of these into a cancerous or a killer cell. Gallo's outspoken ambitions for the Nobel Prize were notorious. As said in the documentary HIV equals AIDS, Fact or Fraud, what else would you expect from a person like Gallo, who had studied retroviruses all his life, that he would say that it was a retrovirus causing AIDS? That seemed to be the first coincidence that made me wonder whether that was an authentic claim. But to me, it was not a surprise that he would say that. He said it before, that it would cause Alzheimer's or leukemia or neurological diseases, and it failed. So I was not too impressed that this was going to be a winner. Following Gallo's announcement, Duisberg spent 18 months studying every scientific publication on HIV and AIDS. He finally published his observations in the prominent journal Cancer Research in March 1987, in an explosive article with the banal title Retroviruses as Carcinogens and Pathogens, Expectations and Reality. Duisberg's article was a tour de force from the reigning father of retrovirology, calling for sobriety in the booming field that he saw spinning out of control. A young generation of virologists, armed with electron microscopes and other novel instruments, and seeking wealth and career advancement, were pinning retroviruses as the culprits for every malignancy, with meager functional or empirical proof, or rigorous evidence-based science to explain the mechanism by which they caused disease. Duisberg exploded the idea that retroviruses cause leukemia, cancers in general, and finally AIDS, the cellular opposite of leukemia. He pointed out that, however one feels about the HIV hypothesis, it was a total reversal of the universal consensus about retroviruses before Gallo's April 1984 press conference. Duisberg reminded his colleagues that retroviruses, which have been a part of the human genome for as long as 3 billion years, are not cytocidal, cell killers. AIDS, Duisberg mused, is a disease of cell death, while leukemia is a disease of cell proliferation. By claiming initially that HIV caused leukemia, and later, AIDS, Gallo was accusing the bug of opposite reactions. Furthermore, Duisberg adds, it would have been the first time that a retrovirus would have been pinned down as a cause of a human disease, or even a disease in wild animals. Duisberg argued that HIV is capable of causing neither cancer nor AIDS. It is instead, he declared, a harmless passenger virus that has almost certainly coexisted in humans for thousands of generations without causing diseases. Duisberg concluded that the creature Gallo claimed to be a pandemic pathogen was simply one of many harmless passenger viruses which innate and adaptive human immunity quickly hold at bay. There are no slow viruses causing AIDS, the acid-tongued Duisberg quipped, only slow scientists. HIV is not pathogenic, either in the industrialized world or the third world. Duisberg's cancer research paper was a lengthy, highly technical paper that raised a series of clear, compelling questions, challenging point by point the basis of Gallo's HIV-AIDS hypothesis. Duisberg's opus was a sweeping reality check against overblown claims for retroviruses, written by the man who at that point in history was thought to know them better than anybody. Many of his colleagues who studied Duisberg's research came to the same conclusion. Something was terribly wrong with the war on AIDS. In 1997, Berkeley's brilliant cell biologist, Dr. Richard Stroman, recalled the impact of Duisberg's elegantly structured arguments in the elite universe of cancer research. It was a remarkable review, and it raised the fundamental issues about virus as a cause of both cancer and immunosuppression, basic questions that haven't been really responded to in any meaningful way in the almost 10 years since the date it was published. Do retroviruses cause diseases? Duisberg's skepticism about HIV-AIDS hypotheses quickly spread across the research community. The most fertile ground for incredulity was among researchers who knew the most about retroviruses. During the late 1990s, diverse teams of elite scientists began working on decoding the human genome. The idea of a cell-killing retrovirus made little sense to them from an evolutionary standpoint. Molecular biologist Harvey Bialy, scientific editor of Nature Biotechnology, remembers where he was when he first heard the news that NCI's Bob Gallo had found the cause of AIDS and that it was a retrovirus. "A colleague told me," said Bialy. "I was on my way to New York. It was January 1984. I remember laughing. A cytopathic retrovirus? This is just more Gallo bullshit," I said. "I said, it will never fly." Bialy points out, "We all have tens of thousands of retroviruses in our germline, and yet none of them has ever been demonstrated to be pathogenic." Bialy told Celia Farber that Gallo, Dr. Fauci, and the thousands of researchers that Dr. Fauci funded to develop ways to kill HIV have never explained how Montagnier's virus could possibly be responsible for all the harms and diseases attributed to it. He said, "It would have been the major single explanation that Gallo's hypothesis would have had to provide in order to be taken seriously. How do you account for the pathogenicity of this sleepy virus that has not a single pathogenic relative, and in fact has 98,000 relatives quietly residing in the human germline? Fuck, 98,000 in the germline, not in your body cells, in your ovaries, getting passed on from generation to generation for as long as human beings have been on this goddamn planet. Every single one of them is clearly not only not pathogenic, but totally harmless. This is the most powerful proof that what Peter has been saying for 20 years now is absolutely correct." Nobel laureate Kary Mullis expressed his astonishment at the credulousness of the scientific community. For him, it defied common sense that, after hundreds of years of scientific research, one medical scientist, Bob Gallo, had suddenly discovered the true cause of 30 ancient diseases in the United States and Europe, and a retinue of at least 30 more in Africa, and traced them all to a simple creature with 100,000 relations, none of them known to cause any disease. "Things don't happen that fast in science," he said. "You don't suddenly notice that one new organism is causing every problem. I mean, it was a bizarre thing that happened, It really was. It didn't really have any precedence in terms of medicine before that. Unless perhaps you could think of the possession by the devil stuff, right? In that, once you're possessed by the devil, anything that happens to you. So it makes it easier for you to get tuberculosis, and it makes it easier for you to get uterine cancer. It makes it easier for you to get Candida albicans. And so all those things can now be called AIDS. Why would anybody do that? Why would any reasonable doctor start lumping together various symptoms into one pile and think all of this is caused by HIV? Christine Maggiore adds, "We have a test, but it's not a test for AIDS, and it's called an HIV test, but it's not a test for HIV. And we have a series of problems that we are calling AIDS, but that doesn't elevate AIDS into a disease." 30 years later, many, if not most, virologists have come to grudgingly accept, in some part at least, Duisberg's skepticism of the Gallo-Fauci claim that HIV alone could cause AIDS. Most research scientists now, quietly, assume that AIDS must have a multifactorial etiology. Significantly, Dr. Robert Gallo and Dr. Luc Montagnier have placed themselves in this cohort. Dr. Tony Fauci is one of the few exceptions. Other respected scientists took Duisberg's doubts even further than Duisberg. Led by Dr. Eleni Papadopoulos and Dr. Val Turner, the Perth group in Australia argues that Gallo's claim was altogether specious, and that neither Gallo nor Montagnier had ever succeeded in even isolating a discrete HIV. In my conversations with Turner and Papadopoulos, and in my reading of their paper, I find their arguments clear and convincing. However, I recognize that there are some 50,000 articles on AIDS in the scientific literature. A casual novitiate like myself has little chance of unraveling this Baroque controversy in a vacuum. Without rigorous debate, the public and press must form opinions based upon appeals to authority, a feature of religion, not of democracy or science. Any debate on that battleground will always be won by self-interested government and industry officials who control the bullhorn and the media. Rather than airing and openly debating such critiques, Tony Fauci and his PI army moved actively and effectively to snuff out the careers and silence the arguments of any scientist or journalist who questioned the official canons of the new state theology. Punishing Duisberg. On their face, Duisberg's incendiary queries seemed to create an irresistible bulwark against Dr. Fauci's HIV-only hypothesis. Even today, Duisberg's rationales appear so clean, so elegantly crafted, and so compelling that, in reading them, it seems impossible that the entire hypothesis did not instantly collapse under the smothering weight of relentless logic. The scientific world waited to see how Drs. Gallo and Fauci could possibly answer Duisberg's devastating questions. But the AIDS cartel never attempted a reply. Instead, Dr. Fauci met this existential assault by simply ignoring it and by castigating anyone who credited it. He set about making Duisberg an example to discourage future inquiries. Dr. Fauci made sure that, in Bialy's words, the article had disastrous professional consequences for Duisberg and sealed his scientific fate for a dozen years. Dr. Fauci orchestrated a fusillade of withering and venomous attacks that effectively ended Duisberg's illustrious career. Dr. Fauci summoned the entire upper clergy of his HIV orthodoxy and all of its lower acolytes and altar boys to unleash a storm of fierce retribution on the Berkeley virologist and his followers. The dispute became one of the most sensational, vicious, and personalized battles in the history of science. Dr. Fauci had a strong stake in the controversy. Blaming AIDS on a virus was the gambit that allowed NIAID to claim the jurisdiction and cash flow away from NCI. Dr. Fauci's career depended on the universal belief that HIV alone causes AIDS. The dispute for him was existential. Led by Dr. Fauci's College of Cardinals, the medical cartel, the emerging highly profitable drug research, testing, and nonprofit charitable HIV/AIDS enterprise, attacked Duesberg and the other dissidents as flat earthers and Holocaust-type denialists, or in Dr. Fauci's estimation, murderers. The AIDS establishment, down to its lowliest doctor, publicly reviled Duesberg, NIH defunded him, and academia ostracized and exiled the brilliant Berkeley professor. The scientific press all but banished him. He became radioactive. From his perch at HHS, Dr. Fauci controlled all the levers of power and public opinion. Shortly after Duesberg's cancer research paper's publication, the Office of the Secretary of Health and Human Services, HHS, sent out a memo under the heading Media Alert. HHS announced the imposition of message discipline harking back to the agency's military roots. The HHS directive rebuked the NIH for allowing Duesberg's paper to reach publication in the first place. The article apparently went through the normal pre-publication process and should have been flagged at NIH, it read. This obviously has the potential to raise a lot of controversy, it added ominously. I have already asked NIH Public Affairs to start digging into this. By questioning the official government theology, and especially by clashing with HHS's reigning technocrat, Duesberg would soon see his generous stream of NIH research grants run dry. When Duesberg's 7-year outstanding investigator grant came up for renewal, it was DOA. As usual, Dr. Fauci had stacked the board. The NIH review committee included one AIDS researcher with deep financial ties to Glaxo, which manufactured AZT, a drug Duesberg ferociously criticized for its extreme toxicity. And another was Gallo's mistress, a scientist in his lab who had mothered his child. Three reviewers never even read Duesberg's proposal. NIH pulled the grant and never again gave Duesberg a single research dollar. Prior to 1987, NIH had never rejected a single one of Peter Duesberg's proposals. After 1987, Duesberg wrote over 30 research proposals. NIH refused every one. The U.S. military-industrial complex, HHS, NIH, NCI, DAIDS, all of it is designed along military command structure because it is, says Celia Farber. It is the military. It's not science and it's not merit. Fauci understands this and has mastered the elimination of both dissent and any mercy for the destroyed. It's a sin, as he has now openly said, to question him, to question science. He's so far gone that he has actually come out and said he is science. I would like Americans to learn who Peter Duesberg is, Farber continues, what his achievements were on cancer genetics, on aneuploidy, and what became of it. I want them to demand answers. Why did Anthony Fauci set out to defund, bully, censor, and destroy America's premier cancer virologist? How do we feel about that? We know how the AIDS activists feel, but how do we feel about it? Most of us have lost at least one family member to cancer, and none to AIDS. Anthony Fauci should be brought before a criminal court and stand trial for destroying American science and virology and cancer science. A lot of the destruction was done through the wildly personal destruction of Peter Duesberg, and anybody who tried to take him seriously or even, for that matter, interview him. The true history is emerging now and will emerge. Fauci will go down as a very dark figure, a travesty. He was obsessed with AIDS. Why? America needed this obsession like a hole in the head. All it was a money trough, a global apparatus of colonial parasitism. We buckled under to Fauci and a handful of shrieking activists. It's truly a tragedy. They just took him out, agrees Richard Stroman, a retired UC Berkeley biologist. Took him right out. A frenzy of anti-Duesbergism swept the field like grass fire. Duesberg's name became so degraded that debasing him became a means of career advancement. Being seen with him was career suicide for aspiring scientists. The system works, said Dave Rasnick. It's as good as a bullet to the head. In a 1988 interview laced with poison and enraged profanity, Gallo denounced Duesberg for questioning his HIV-AIDS hypothesis. HIV kills like a truck, he hollered. HIV would kill Clark Kent. Duesberg's riposte at the time was that he wouldn't mind being injected with HIV so long as the sample didn't come from Gallo's lab. The scientifically illiterate mass media largely ignored Duesberg's evidence-based arguments as dangerous apostasies. Dr. Fauci showcased his easy capacity to control his servile media toadies and mobilize the public health cartel to punish skepticism and dissent. It was a tour de force and an extraordinary preview of his later censorship campaigns. This was a decade before FDA's 1997 consequential decision to allow pharmaceutical advertising on television, so Dr. Fauci's urgency in quickly summoning the media to obediently fall in line was all the more impressive. Subsumed in the received orthodoxy, fawning media outlets parroted the official caveat of the NIAID Inquisition. To even acknowledge Duesberg's arguments was itself dangerous, because it deflected valuable time from the business of saving lives and lent credence to deadly heresy. To mention Duesberg's name was irresponsible journalism. AIDS organizations posted warnings about Duesberg and his fellow denialists on their websites. Project Inform's Martin Delaney, living fat by then on Dr. Fauci's payroll, conducted letter writing and phone campaigns vowing to get every journalist who interviewed Duesberg fired. Delaney would later come around to Duesberg's view that HIV could not solely cause AIDS. It wasn't a particularly time-consuming project. Very few journalists wanted to undertake the risk. As noted earlier, Anthony Fauci personally made sure Duesberg almost never appeared on national television. Dr. Fauci demonstrated his mastery at intimidating TV networks. In one case, Good Morning America had already booked Duesberg and flown him to New York. On the night preceding his appearance, a GMA producer called to say the show was canceled. In the morning, he turned on his hotel TV and saw Anthony Fauci himself on the show. Similarly, Larry King asked Duesberg for a televised interview in 1992, and then abruptly canceled the night before. Dr. Fauci took Duesberg's place at King's table. In 1987, when President Reagan invited Duesberg and Dr. Fauci to the White House for a friendly debate in front of the president, Dr. Fauci forced Reagan to cancel. A member of President Reagan's administration told Duesberg that Anthony Fauci, far from reacting as anticipated, threw a small fit when he was invited and demanded to know why the White House was interfering in scientific matters that belonged to the NIH and the Office of Science and Technology Assessment. Anthony Fauci's uninterrupted flow of millions of dollars to its labs and med school had by the 1980s transformed Berkeley, a mecca for free speech in the 1960s, into an omphalos of reaction and medical heterodoxy. In a pioneering template for cancel culture, the university unceremoniously stripped Duesberg, then at the very top of his field, of everything. Government funding, grad students, a proper lab, and invitations to conferences. Only his tenured position prevented Berkeley from ridding itself of the iconoclastic researcher altogether. The university refused to endorse Duisberg's appeal to the NIH of his grant revocation. Without university support, he could not legally proceed. Duisberg has had to hire a lawyer to fight for his standard annual merit pay increase, which usually comes automatically to professors of his stature. UC Berkeley denied Duisberg his raise for over a decade, claiming his work was not of high significance. Wary of ruining their careers, all his grad students abandoned Duisberg. The university warned them that working with Duisberg would make them pariahs. All scientific conferences disinvited him. Prominent colleagues demonstrated their rectitude by publicly declaring that they would decline invitations to any conference that included Duisberg. One of his Berkeley colleagues complimented Duisberg lavishly in a private interview with journalist Celia Farber. The colleague praised his integrity, his genius, his kindness, and his intelligence. She protested his shoddy treatment by the university and the scientific establishment, but she insisted that she did not want to be identified in Farber's story, explaining that she feared retribution. Another Berkeley colleague from the Donner Lab explained to Farber the general hesitancy about Duisberg among the faculty. Peter may be right about HIV, but there's an industry now. The scientific press banished Duisberg from publishing. Nature editor John Maddox himself wrote a theatrical editorial stating that Duisberg, by his heresy, had forfeited the standard scientific publishing practice right of reply. Maddox invited Duisberg's colleagues to slander the virologist without fear of response. Anti-Duisberg ambuscades became pro forma in each new edition of Nature. Bialy's biography of Duisberg renders this written record in vivid, often hilarious detail. Even the proceeding of the National Academy of Sciences Journal, PNAS, where members are always invited to publish, crushed a Duisberg paper on HIV after he spent over a year revising and resubmitting it to meet their various editing requests. Colleagues reckless enough to defend Duisberg found themselves in malodor. The virologist Harry Rubin, himself a member of the Academy, suffered toxic vitriol and career injury after he intervened vainly with PNAS to get Duisberg's paper published. In 1992, Duisberg's paper became the second one in the PNAS's 128-year history to be blocked from publication. The other was written by Linus Pauling. Duisberg's problem was one that transcended science. It was career protection to partake in his bullying and degradation, said Farber. The Fauci serf scientists were driven by fear that if they did not denounce Duisberg in sufficiently disgusted tones and very publicly, they would themselves soon be punished by Fauci, possibly defunded, or worse. The medical cartel dangled the prizes of redemption and reinstatement before Duisberg if he would only agree to reform. In 1994, a high-ranking NIH geneticist, Dr. Stephen O'Brien, called Duisberg and said he urgently needed to see him about a professional matter. O'Brien flew in from Bethesda the next day, and the two met at the opera in San Francisco. After some small talk about the good old days, O'Brien pulled a manuscript from the inside pocket of his tuxedo. Headlined HIV Causes AIDS, Koch's Postulates Fulfilled, it had three very incongruous names at the bottom: Stephen O'Brien, William Blattner, and Peter Duisberg. Nature editor John Maddox had commissioned this apologia as inducement. If Duisberg would only sign the mea culpa, O'Brien implored, he could have everything back. He would be back at the top again. back in the safe bastion of Dr. Fauci's medical and science establishment, Duisberg refused the bribe. In a 2009 documentary, Duisberg is somewhat empathetic, if not sympathetic, toward his detractors. "They are prostitutes," he said, "most of them my colleagues, and to some degree, myself. You have to be a prostitute to get money for your research. You're trained a little bit to be a prostitute." He smiles and adds, "But some go all the way." Refusal to debate. For several years, journalist John Lauritsen tried to get any scientist at NIH to answer the questions in Duisberg's article, but the orders had come from NIAID that no government scientist should respond. NIH officials repeatedly told Lauritsen that none of the scientists for Robert Gallo in government were interested in discussing the etiology of AIDS. Lauritsen was therefore intrigued when the New York Times reported Tony Fauci's laconic official response to Duisberg's article. "The evidence that HIV causes AIDS is so overwhelming that it almost doesn't deserve any discussion anymore." Lauritsen complained to me, "As a member of the press, I thought I should have been allowed to speak to Dr. Fauci and ask him to reveal just one or two pieces of overwhelming evidence that HIV is the cause of AIDS. How did he get away with this? His only strategy was to act as if the evidence was so overwhelming that no one should be allowed to question the assertion." Fauci adopted the posture that neither he nor his colleagues had any obligation to reply to Duisberg or any of his other critics. It was the secular version of the doctrine of papal infallibility. Everyone must just accept the AIDS virus theory as a matter of fact because the public health pope declares it. Harvey Bialy, founding scientific editor of Nature Biotechnology, said, "I am very tired of hearing AIDS establishment scientists tell me they are too busy saving lives to sit down and refute Peter Duisberg's arguments, although each one assures me they could do it in a minute if they had to." In 2006, Britain's preeminent epidemiologist Gordon Stewart voiced a similar frustration. "I have asked the health authorities, editors-in-chief, and other experts concerned with HIV/AIDS repeatedly for proof of their theses, and I've been waiting for an answer since 1984. Dr. Fauci's own refusal to debate his theories is just the tip of the iceberg. Dr. Fauci's control of his PI army gives him the ability to shut down all debate. When National Public Radio attempted to stage a conversation between Duisberg and a supporter of the HIV hypothesis, it could find no one willing to confront him. Critiquing a dubious theory would take time away from more productive efforts, Anthony Fauci, head of NIAID, told NPR producers. When Bialy challenged Dr. John Moore of Cornell University to a debate on AIDS, Moore wrote in reply, "Participating in any public forum with the likes of Bialy would give him a credibility that he does not merit. The science community does not debate with the AIDS denialists. It treats them with the utter contempt that they deserve and exposes them for the charlatans that they are. Kindly do not send me any further communications on this or any related matter." Such scathing rebuffs infuriated Nobel laureate Carey Mullis. In 2004, he said, "All we have is Bob Gallo saying, 'Gentlemen, this is the cause of AIDS.' That's all we have. That's all we had. That's not enough. That is not sufficient to publish even a meager little scientific paper somewhere, much less a basis to spend millions or billions of dollars a year and the cost of a lot of lives and anguish. Lives have been totally ruined on the basis of some flimsy little statement made by a guy who's known to be a crook in lots of other ways. He lied about a whole lot of other stuff. Why are we trusting him? If he was a witness in a courtroom, we wouldn't trust his testimony. We've caught him in too many lies. We don't trust him anymore. Some 20 years after Gallo's announcement, circumstances finally forced Dr. Fauci to defend his thesis. In 2009, documentarian Brent Leung persuaded Dr. Fauci to submit to a sit-down interview for Leung's feature-length film on the history of AIDS, House of Numbers, Anatomy of an Epidemic. Leung asked an uncomfortable, chafing Dr. Fauci for his best evidence linking HIV to immune deficiency disease. With 2 decades and $10 billion to prepare his answer, Dr. Fauci's best explanation was the classic Fauci soft shoe. Contemporary Americans will recognize the familiar refrain of double-talking and dissembling that we all now recognize from the NIAID director's COVID-19 interviews. He said, "When you put the combined findings of the initial characterization as a distinct retrovirus, isolated by Montagnier and his group, together with Gallo linking the virus to being the cause of AIDS, and they put those things together, that's how we have a confirmation of the causative agent of AIDS, namely HIV." Translating all that into regular English, which Charles Ortlieb remarked to me with a laugh, takes just 3 words. Gallo says so. That's what Fauci calls a confirmation. Among Dr. Fauci's skeptics were numerous Nobel laureates, including geneticist Barbara McClintock and chemist Walter Gilbert, who added their voices to the chorus complaining about the lack of scientific proof supporting the HIV/AIDS hypothesis and the inability or unwillingness of health officials to answer fundamental questions. "It is good that the HIV hypothesis is being questioned," Gilbert told the Oakland Tribune in 1989. Gilbert acknowledged it is absolutely correct that no one has proven that AIDS is caused by the AIDS virus. And Duisberg is absolutely correct that the virus cultured in the laboratory may not be the cause of AIDS. Mullis, one of the most significant Nobel laureates of the 20th century, died in 2019. "People keep asking me," he explained in 1994. "You mean you don't believe that HIV causes AIDS? And I say, whether I believe it or not is irrelevant. I have no scientific evidence for it. If there is proof that HIV is the cause of AIDS, there should be scientific documents which either singly or collectively demonstrate that fact, at least with a high probability. There is no such document." Mullis observed in 1994 that the financial and career incentives for advancement to any researcher who could demonstrate a formal proof of Dr. Fauci's proposition are so monumentally enormous that the inability of anybody to produce this demonstration is itself compelling evidence that HIV alone does not cause AIDS. If a postdoc were to write a review of the literature that showed without much doubt that HIV was the cause of AIDS, that guy would be famous. There are 100,000 guys out there who had the opportunity. 10 years have passed. We've been waiting for this star postdoctoral fellow to distinguish himself forever and get a lifelong grant from Tony Fauci, but he hasn't shown up. No one has bothered to write a definitive review. Any journal would take it. That right there proves that HIV does not cause AIDS. Duisberg's most surprising convert was Luc Montagnier, the man who first discovered the virus. At the San Francisco International AIDS Conference in 1990, Dr. Montagnier made a startling confession about HIV that was clearly against his own interest. HIV might be benign. Montagnier was the father of the AIDS theory. He is also a scientist of integrity. That was his surrender flag. Montagnier's discounting of the HIV/AIDS Association should have been earth-shaking. Instead, the conventioneers, content with the orthodoxy that was paying off handsomely for so many of them, ignored Montagnier's momentous confession and went right on talking about exciting new antiviral drug treatments. Carrie Mullis was astonished that Fauci's dogma had such a powerful hypnotic force that acolytes would ignore its public retraction by the genius who invented it. Years from now, people looking back at us will find our acceptance of the HIV theory of AIDS as silly as we find the leaders who excommunicated Galileo just because he insisted that the Earth was not the center of the universe, predicts Mullis. It has been disappointing that so many scientists have absolutely refused to examine the available evidence in a neutral, dispassionate way regarding whether HIV causes AIDS. All about the money. Today, the presumption that HIV is the sole cause of AIDS is the central presumption of a multi-billion-dollar industry. Everyone agrees that at least part of the explanation for its stupefying resilience is Dr. Fauci's relentless flow of cash. Charles Ortleb observed to me, "Science costs money, and he who dispenses the money can control the science." Look, there's no sociological mystery here, observed Mullis. It's just people's income and position being threatened by the things Peter Duisberg is saying. Their personal income and positions are being threatened, and that's why they're so nasty. In the 1980s, a lot of people started being dependent on Tony Fauci and his friends for their livelihood. All these people really wanted success in the sense of lots of people working for them and lots of power. Bialy agrees. First of all, there are tremendous financial and social interests involved. Billions of dollars in research funding, stock options, and activist budgets are predicated on the assumption that HIV causes AIDS. Entire industries of pharmaceutical drugs, diagnostic testing, and activist causes would have no reason to exist. The 2004 documentary, The Other Side of AIDS, includes a remarkable scene in which Canadian PI Mark Weinberg, MD, president of the International AIDS Society, the world's largest organization of AIDS researchers and clinicians, angrily calls for Duisberg and others who attempt to dispel the notion that HIV is the cause of AIDS to be brought up on trial. He considers HIV/AIDS skeptics perpetrators of death. I suggest to you that Peter Duisberg is the closest thing we have on this planet to a scientific psychopath. Then he declares the interview over, rips the microphone from his lapel, and storms off. What happened next was revealing. The audience erupted in laughter, which turned to boos as the screen flashed a list of Weinberg's patents and other financial ties to the HIV industry. Other causes. If HIV doesn't cause AIDS, one is bound to ask, then what does? Leading scientists have advanced multiple credible theories to account for AIDS pathogenesis. I will examine three of the most compelling, beginning with Duisberg's theory, since his explanation arrived first chronologically and inspired the largest and most influential following. Subsequent theories, including hypotheses promoted ironically by Robert Gallo and Luc Montagnier, have equal persuasive power, but enjoyed meager public interest or support. Duisberg's battle royal had demonstrated Dr. Fauci's sizable power to destroy careers, and no one after Duisberg had the courage and appetite to challenge the little director by advancing new theories. Duisberg's theory. Duisberg, Mullis, and their school of critics blame all the lethal symptomology known as AIDS on a multiplicity of environmental exposures that became ubiquitous in the 1980s. The HIV virus, this group insists, was a kind of free rider that was also associated with overlapping lifestyle exposures. Duisberg and many who have followed him offered evidence that heavy recreational drug use in gay men and drug addicts was the real cause of immune deficiency among the first generation of AIDS sufferers. They argued that the initial signals of AIDS, Kaposi sarcoma, and pneumocystis carinii pneumonia, PCP, were both strongly linked to amyl nitrite, poppers, a popular drug among promiscuous gays. Other common wasting symptoms were all associated with heavy drug use and lifestyle stressors. Those interested in exploring the debate should read Chapter 3, Virus Hunting Takes Over, of Duisberg's riveting book, Inventing the AIDS Virus. Suffice it to say that Duisberg makes a compelling case, and his arguments deserve to be aired and civilly debated. Dr. Duisberg observed that critical AIDS cases in the 1980s were among men engaged in behaviors then commonplace in the post-Stonewall, drug-charged gay party scene. Risk factors included promiscuous sex with multiple partners and cumulative toxic exposures from psychoactive drugs including methadrine, cocaine, heroin, LSD, and a cocktail of antibiotics prescribed to treat ubiquitous sexually transmitted diseases. On average, the early AIDS patients had been on at least 3 antibiotics courses in the year preceding diagnosis. Some 35% of early AIDS cases were among IV drug users. In his paper, The Role of Drugs in the Origin of AIDS, Duisberg cites over a dozen medical references documenting AIDS-like immunodeficiency symptoms among drug addicts since 1900. The medical literature attests to the ravaging effects of heroin, morphine, speed, cocaine, and other injected drugs on the immune system. From as early as 1909, evidence has accumulated that addiction to psychoactive drugs leads to immune suppression, clinical autoimmunity, similar to AIDS. Today, thousands of American junkies who are not infected with HIV are losing the same CD4 plus T cells and getting the same diseases as AIDS patients. STDs from promiscuous sex and bloodborne diseases like hepatitis A, B, and C added to the immune suppression among this cohort. Duisberg's theory was by no means novel or outlandish. Dr. Fauci himself conceded in 1984 that drugs were a reasonable explanation for PCP and other signature symptoms of AIDS. "If I were to take drugs," he said, "that would markedly immunosuppress me, there would be a reasonably good chance that I would get that pneumonia. That's what happens to the AIDS individuals." Poppers and drugs. Prior to Gallo's discovery of HIV, the initial guess by government researchers and leading scientists was that recreational drugs were the prime suspects. Duke Medical School's renowned infectious disease expert, Professor David Durek, who served on NIH's bioethics committee, asked the still relevant question in his lead article in the December 1981 New England Journal of Medicine: "How can AIDS be so evidently new when viruses and homosexuality are as old as history?" Recreational drugs, according to Durek, should be considered as causes. "They are widely used," he said, "in the large cities where most of these cases have occurred. Perhaps, as suggested, one or more of these recreational drugs is an immunosuppressive agent." Durek observed that, other than drug-using homosexuals, the only patients with AIDS symptoms were junkies. In Duisberg's view, the highest risk addiction was the ubiquitous use of amyl nitrite poppers, which had well-established links with autoimmune disease. The first AIDS cases were 5 gay men, all unknown to one another, diagnosed with a rare PCP pneumonia and Kaposi sarcoma, a form of cancer that had previously afflicted only elderly men. In Los Angeles, in 1981, Dr. Michael Gottlieb, a researcher searching California hospitals for new diseases with unusual symptomology, is credited with the initial discovery and characterization of the disease and its epidemiologic context. The men were all promiscuous party enthusiasts in the fast-lane gay lifestyle. They were taking many different recreational drugs simultaneously and combining drugs in excess of patterns among straight drug users. They frequented bars, clubs, and bathhouses. They had daily multiple anonymous sexual partners, upward of 1,000 per year, and contracted most of the common sexually transmitted diseases like syphilis, gonorrhea, and hepatitis B. They were, therefore, also functionally addicted to a pharmacopoeia of antibiotic prescription medications. All of that created a situation where a handful of gay men, says Mark Gabrish Conlon, were burning the candle at both ends and putting a blowtorch to the middle. It's no wonder that after a while their immune systems started to collapse and they started getting sick in these unusual ways that previously had only been seen in older people whose immune systems had deteriorated from age. John Lauritsen, a gay activist, was probably the longest-running AIDS journalist. My first major AIDS article was in 1985, he said. The very early AIDS cases were really quite sick, and there were very good reasons why they were sick. Lauritsen and many leading medical researchers and government health officials concluded early in the epidemic that paupers were the lead culprit. Chemists developed amyl nitrite as a vasodilator in the 1850s and began in the 1960s packaging it in glass ampoules that doctors would pop open under the noses of unconscious patients to reanimate them. That same mechanism that prompted reanimation provided the relaxation of the anal musculature and a powerful rush that made paupers the reigning sex drug. Paupers became a mainstay of the gay social scene in the late 1970s. Prior to 1987, every AIDS patient acknowledged heavy consumption of paupers. Every porn shop, bar, and bathhouse locker room sold paupers. Party gays huffed them continuously in dance clubs and during extreme sex. The saloons and dance halls reeked of their pungent chemical aroma. At the end of each evening, bartenders routinely announced, "Last call for alcohol, last call for paupers." Researchers believe paupers to be the direct cause of Kaposi's sarcoma, a rare form of skin cancer that afflicts the nose, throat, lungs, and skin. Kaposi sarcoma was the initial indicator disease of AIDS, but it was also common in gay men who were not infected with HIV. Paupers can severely damage the immune system, genes, lungs, liver, heart, or the brain. They can produce neural damage similar to that of multiple sclerosis, can have carcinogenic effects, and can lead to sudden sniffing death. I discovered there was a very extensive medical literature on the volatile nitrites, Lauritsen explains. The simplest thing is that they are very powerful oxidizing agents, which is part of AIDS causes, in fact, several types of anemia. Secondly, paupers are powerfully mutagenic and carcinogenic, meaning that they cause cellular changes and cancer. One of my informants, Filson, who was very active and outgoing in the People with AIDS Coalition, claimed that he had interviewed several hundred gay men with AIDS, and he said that virtually all of them had been heavy users of drugs. They said without a single exception, they had all been paupers users. A study published by Toby Eisenstein showed that nitrites found in paupers are radically immunosuppressive in rodents. Government researchers and regulatory officials supported the association. Prior to Gallo's announcement, CDC had targeted paupers as the likely culprit for AIDS. A year before Gallo's announcement, CDC's in-house AIDS expert Harry Haverkos analyzed three surveys of AIDS patients conducted by the CDC. He concluded that drugs like paupers played a key role in the disease onset. L.T. Sigel wrote in the American Journal of Psychiatry that the inhaled nitrites produced nitrosamine, known for its carcinogenic effects. Thomas Haley of the Food and Drug Administration issued the same warning. Following Gallo's 1984 press conference, Dr. Fauci launched a mission to quash all conversation about cofactors like paupers. The CDC quickly fell in line. The CDC shelved the Haverkost study and began parroting Dr. Fauci's hostility toward the drug connection. The CDC actively suppressed disagreeable data and published one of its signature junk science papers to prove paupers safe. The CDC researchers assumed that gays used paupers as single-use reanimators and exposed laboratory mice to lifetime doses, a thousandth of what a gay man would get in one evening on the party circuit. The study was utterly fraudulent, remarks Lauritsen. Haverkost transferred to the FDA in 1984 to become AIDS coordinator there. His paper finally appeared in the journal Sexually Transmitted Diseases in 1985, prompting the Wall Street Journal to pen an article arguing that substance abuse was so universal among AIDS patients that drug use and not Dr. Fauci's virus must be considered the primary cause of AIDS. According to Randy Schiltz, writing in his classic History of the AIDS Crisis and the Band Played On, the pauper's starting point offers a compelling explanation for AIDS. Everybody who got diseases seemed to snort paupers, writes Schiltz. As I wrote this book, children's health defense researcher Robin Ross, Esquire, alerted me to one of the unheralded ironies of this saga. As it turns out, Burroughs Wellcome holds the 1942 patent on the pauper container and remained one of the largest manufacturers of paupers during the 1980s and 90s. As early as 1977, a New York Daily News article described Burroughs Wellcome's strategies for dodging criticism of widespread health injuries from its booming pauper sales. As we shall presently see, Burroughs Wellcome and other pauper manufacturers were the principal sources of advertising revenues to the gay press during that epoch, and they used that leverage to force censorship of any journalist attempting to link amyl nitrite to immune system collapse. If Duesberg and others are correct about that association, it means that Burroughs Wellcome was profiting from both causing the AIDS epidemic and then from poisoning a generation of gay men with the AZT cure. Tony Fauci played traffic cop in this feedback loop. On the one hand, he was using his regulatory authority to promote AZT and to kill its competition, effectively orchestrating Burroughs Wellcome's monopoly control over AIDS treatment. At the same time, he was suppressing the study of the toxicity of paupers and directing the blame for AIDS on the virus, thereby shielding Burroughs Wellcome from significant liability.